This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Cambodia in the second half of the 70s was the site of the killing fields when the Khmer Rouge slaughtered hundreds of thousands of their own people. Cambodia is now the site of the biggest UN peacekeeping operation in history. By the summer, there will be almost 16,000 soldiers, 3,600 police, and 2,400 civilians under the UN banner. My guest, Stan Sesser, reports on Cambodia in the current issue of The New Yorker. He covers Southeast Asia for the magazine. The Cambodian Peace Accord emerged from a 19-nation conference held in Paris last October under the auspices of the UN. Here's the basics of the agreement.
It's a gargantuan job for the United Nations. They're undertaking a peace process that's never been tried before. It's the first major effort of the UN in the post-Cold War world to do something that's going to be very positive. They're going into Cambodia, and in effect, first of all, they're supervising the government in Phnom Penh. This is the government of Prime Minister Hun Sen, which is at odds with the other three factions that are also involved in the peace process. They're supervising the government to make certain that this government, which has been very rigid and totalitarian in the past, allows free elections. Then they're trying to disarm all the 400,000 soldiers in Cambodia of the four factions, the government and the three opposing factions. Then they're trying to bring back 330,000 refugees from Thailand and resettle them, even though Cambodia is strewn with mines, millions of mines, and the mine clearing process has just begun. And next year, what's supposed to emerge from this process is free and fair elections in a country that has never known free elections before. Cambodia is 80% rural, and the peasants in the villages of Cambodia have no idea what a vote is. And suddenly they're being confronted with the idea of different candidates for election, and the UN is supposed to somehow make this all comprehensible. And then on top of all this, no one knows where the $2 billion is going to come from, because there's always plenty of money to make war, but Congress and the administration and other countries are balking at paying for the peacekeeping efforts.
Do you see this in a way as an experiment on the UN's part to see how powerful the UN could be in keeping a peace?
If it's an experiment on the UN's part, they've taken probably the most difficult country in the world to do this with. Because after all, the Khmer Rouge, the mass murderers who killed 1.5 million Cambodians in the 1970s, are part of this so-called peace process. And how do you make the Khmer Rouge peaceful when their same leaders are still heading it?
Well, you compare including the Khmer Rouge in the peace process to if the Allies invited the Nazis back to participate in post-war German government. What's the official logic behind inviting the Khmer Rouge into the peace process?
The logic is that the Khmer Rouge are less dangerous participating in the peace, running against the other factions in elections, than they would be on the Thai border as a military force, and that on the Thai border they would always be destabilizing Cambodia. It's an argument that is open to lots of criticism.
Do you buy the argument?
No, I personally don't, because the Khmer Rouge, well, you have to go back a little into history. If the United States is equated to Dr. Frankenstein, the Khmer Rouge is the monster that Dr. Frankenstein created. The Khmer Rouge were able to take over Cambodia only because Cambodia was completely destabilized by American bombing of Cambodia starting in 1969 and by an American-inspired coup in 1970, under which a right-wing general named Lon Nol overthrew Prince Sihanouk and took control of Cambodia and then started to loot the country. And the Khmer Rouge took advantage of this destabilization and claimed to be nationalists who were restoring Cambodia to its own identity, taking it away from the Americans and the other foreigners who were looting the country. And the Khmer Rouge gained power that way. Then they started their mass murders. And then in 1979, Vietnam felt so threatened by the Khmer Rouge, the Pol Pot government, that Vietnam invaded Cambodia and drove the Khmer Rouge out. And at this point, the Khmer Rouge were nothing. They could have been destroyed. But the United States, China, and Thailand chose to support the Khmer Rouge on the Thai border. All during the 1980s, the United States voted for the Khmer Rouge each year to hold the seat in the United Nations, the Cambodian seat. And this was all done because of the American blind hatred of Vietnam.
So what do you think the United States government thinks of the Khmer Rouge now?
Well, I think the United States government, seeing this monster that they've created being back in Phnom Penh, hopes very much that our old enemy, the Hun Sen government originally installed by Vietnam, wins the elections. It's the ultimate irony. We did everything we could to nourish the Khmer Rouge during the 1980s, and now they're back in Phnom Penh as part of the peace process, and now suddenly they might win. They might actually regain Cambodia through the peace process because the Hun Sen government is so corrupt that the Cambodians are turning against it. It's the same situation as when General Lon Nol was raping the country in the early 1970s.
I don't know, given the choice, if I had it between corruption and death, I'd choose corruption.
Yeah, but the Khmer Rouge have a nice line. I mean, they're playing to the rural population. Of course, no one in Phnom Penh is going to support the Khmer Rouge, but Phnom Penh has 900,000 people, less than 10% of the population of Cambodia, and farmers who are illiterate, who have no concept of what the Khmer Rouge have done when they see all the corruption in Phnom Penh and when they see nothing at all going to the rural areas, and then the Khmer Rouge come in and with this campaign that we're going to restore you. We're going to bring you the resources that you need so much, that we're going to support you, and we're going to get rid of these people in Phnom Penh. It has appeal in the rural areas. No one knows how much appeal it has, but again, the Khmer Rouge, if they don't succeed in the elections after a number of tries, and they're being very patient, if they don't succeed in the elections, they're undoubtedly going to try again to succeed militarily.
What are the American interests now in Cambodia?
The American interests in Cambodia, the United States has never had any interests in Cambodia, really. We've used Cambodia to bomb the areas near Vietnam in the 1960s and 1970s, and we've had no economic interest in Cambodia. We've had no close ties with Cambodia. Cambodia means nothing to the United States except as a buffer between Vietnam and pro-Western Thailand. But now the only interest in Cambodia is that Cambodia alone could destabilize all of Southeast Asia. We have Vietnam throwing off its traditional communist economy and opening up to the West and stabilizing, and Laos doing the same thing, and China at peace with Vietnam and Laos, and Thailand looking upon Indochina as a marketplace. And here's Cambodia in the middle of all this, threatening to wreck the whole rebuilding of Southeast Asia.
Future joining us, my guest is Stan Sesser. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker and covers Southeast Asia. He has an article about Cambodia in the current issue of The New Yorker. One of the Khmer Rouge who's returned to Cambodia is Sun Sen, and he was the Khmer leader who oversaw torture of those about to be executed. What's he doing now? And I wonder if you talked to him or tried to talk to him?
No, the Khmer Rouge don't grant interviews.
Right,
they're not. They don't have much of a public relations setup. Some reporters get to them, but it takes a decade of cultivation to be able to talk to them. There's really only one Western reporter who's able to talk to Khmer Rouge officials, and I'm not able to. And what Sun Sen is doing is he's taking orders. Sun Sen and Khoo Samphan, the two Khmer Rouge leaders who are in Phnom Penh now, are taking orders from Pol Pot. Pol Pot's on the Thai border being supported by the Thai army, and Pol Pot is determining the future of Cambodia. And no one knows just what the game plan of the Khmer Rouge is going to be.
Prince Sihanouk ruled Cambodia from 1943 until 1970, when he was overthrown by Lon Nol with the help of America. So what is Prince Sihanouk's reputation now that he's returned to Cambodia?
Sihanouk is still looked upon as the only leader who can keep Cambodia together. His participation in the peace process is of extreme importance. And no one knows whether Sihanouk can be trusted or not. He's made so many shifts. In the West, Sihanouk's reputation is being pretty flaky and not trustworthy. But others in Phnom Penh say that all these the mercurial nature of Sihanouk is due to his having to move back and forth in a desperate situation and attempt to salvage his country when the United States was bombing it, when the Khmer Rouge were doing what they did. Sihanouk has been pressed and has had so few resources, and this might account for his desperate efforts to ally with whatever faction, with whatever country will support him. And right now he's playing the role of a diplomat, and he's very impressive. He's very impressive to watch. He's really playing the role of a king.
What is the mood about the election scheduled for the spring of 1993 in Cambodia? What's the mood inside Cambodia? Are people optimistic about them?
Well, no one knows quite how it's going to happen. How do you have free elections when, first of all, there's no newspaper that's not controlled by the government? Radio and television is controlled by the government. The whole road system of Cambodia is in ruins. How do you reach all the villages? Landmines are everywhere. The refugees have to be resettled first before they can start voting, and only 10,000 are going to be resettled by June 1st when the monsoons come. And how will the rest of the 320,000 remaining refugees get back? And then how do you teach people about elections? It's quite a test for the UN to see whether they can pull this off. And then to top it all off, it seems that all the independent candidates who announce that they're going to start their own political parties are getting knocked off by a mysterious death squad that people suspect is part of the Interior Ministry, but no one knows for sure.
And the UN peacekeeping force isn't able to control that.
Well, how do you stop people? They're like mafia hitmen. They're riding through the streets of Phnom Penh shooting at independent candidates. And you really can't stop that, and that's a real worry. You're superimposing on a country that's known nothing but violence suddenly the system of free elections, as if they're going to go from hundreds of years of violence and despotism to an American-style democracy overnight. Can it be done? Can this happen? I don't know. A lot of other countries in Southeast Asia, they're supposedly a lot freer, are still having problems with democracy.
Stan, let me reintroduce you. My guest is Stan Susser. He writes about Southeast Asia for The New Yorker, where he's a staff writer. His article about Cambodia is in the current edition of the magazine. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the peacekeeping process being overseen by the United Nations in Cambodia, and my guest is journalist Stan Susser. What happens after the elections in May 1993 when the UN peacekeeping forces leave? I mean, even if the elections go really well, do you have any faith that the country would remain stable after the UN forces are gone?
Well, first of all, the Hun Sen government is certain to be elected. The Khmer Rouge aren't going to win the first time. There has to be a lot more problems with the country, a lot more corruption before the Khmer Rouge have a chance. So the Hun Sen government will be elected. And then the UN leaves, and then the problems start, because the Hun Sen government itself is not unified. Hun Sen is a relative liberal, but at least a very large part of the government consists of the old line Stalinists who are interested in liberalization of the economy only to the extent that they can make more money off of it, because it will bring more goods and money into the country and will enhance their opportunities for corruption. And then what happens when the UN leaves? Corruption will increase even more, and eventually the country just has to turn against this, as it turned against Lon Nol in the 1970s. And the Khmer Rouge are there hoping to profit by it.
I have to say, you know, this is such a massive campaign on the part of the United Nations to create peace and some form of democracy in Cambodia. And you sound so really skeptical that Cambodia really can change right now. Do you think that this is something of a pointless exercise?
I don't think it's a pointless exercise, because I think it sets a very important precedent. The idea of UN intervention will have to be worked out over a period of years, or who knows, maybe decades, to make it an effective force. And it's going to be more effective in some places, for instance, as it has been in Namibia, than it perhaps will be in Cambodia. But I think it's a very important precedent. I don't think that we can allow the United States to be the one superpower in the world that will dictate the fate of countries like Cambodia. I mean, look at what's happened over, look at all the damage the United States has caused in Cambodia from when our bombing started in 1969 through the 1980s with our tacit support of the Khmer Rouge. It's been devastating, and I would much rather have the decisions in the hands of the UN than in the hands of the United States. And Cambodia, the effort in Cambodia might fail, but I think it's an important effort. And I might be wrong. It might succeed. And if it succeeds, the UN has pulled off a miracle and can do it anywhere else in the world, Yugoslavia and anywhere else, if they can get through the thicket of Cambodia.
I'm interested in hearing how the Khmer Rouge have permanently changed the face of Cambodia. You have a really horrifying statistic in your piece in The New Yorker. You're talking about how the Khmer slaughtered everyone with an education. And there are, you say, 43 of 485 doctors who survived the reign of the Khmer Rouge.
Yeah, it's astonishing to be in Cambodia now and see what has happened. Essentially, you have a situation where a large number of people with intelligence are dead, and the people left. I mean, all the posts of government have to be staffed now with the people who survived, and all the intellectuals and all the scholars and all the teachers and all the doctors are dead, and it's a real problem. It's a real problem finding people to do things. You can't even. Autos can't be repaired in Cambodia. From tiny little things, they have to bring in Vietnamese to repair their cars, and there are no doctors in the hospitals, and there's no medical equipment, and there are no teachers, and all this has to be created from scratch. And the country is devastated. It's just devastated.
Stan, how about a little history lesson in why the Khmer singled out people with education and slaughtered them?
They had a theory. This Kusampan was one of the two Khmer Rouge leaders who are now in Phnom Penh. Was their theorist. He was an intellectual, educated in Paris, and the theory was one of Cambodia regaining its nationality. It's Cambodia has always been under French domination, and then Japanese, and then American, and then in Vietnamese, and the theory was that to regain its identity as a nation, the peasants have to rise up and overthrow the educated classes, because the educated classes were tools of the corrupt foreigners and were being used by the corrupt foreigners for the foreigners' own purpose, and. The theory was that there was just no place for educated people, and then later in the Khmer Rouge years, it turned into just massive paranoia, where the Khmer Rouge were not only killing doctors and teachers, but they were killing their own people, their own officials. There were massive purges. It was sort of like Stalin in the early 1950s, where they didn't even trust themselves.
I want to get back to something you were saying earlier. You said that when it comes to the elections, a lot of the rural people could conceivably vote for the Khmer Rouge because they really didn't know about many of the atrocities committed under the Khmer. That's kind of hard to believe.
No. They knew about the atrocities, but the atrocities, in a way, affected them less than it did the people of the cities. It was the educated people of the cities who were being murdered.
I see.
And in many instances, the rural people were given positions of authority within the Cambodian government. Uneducated peasants were given positions of authority. That's the first thing. But the second thing is that people are much more concerned in Cambodia with what's happening now, with an effort to restore their lives, than they are with what happened 15 years ago. And what they see now is causing tremendous resentment when they see the prosperity of Phnom Penh and when there's nothing whatsoever going into the rural areas. And you look at Phnom Penh and you see all these people getting rich and you look at yourself and you see that you can't feed your family. And the Khmer Rouge come along and they say, we're the only alternative. We're opposed to all this. And as Khoo Samphan, one of the Khmer Rouge leaders, said on a radio broadcast last November, he said, let's forget the past. And it's ironic, the Cambodian peasantry today doesn't have the luxury of remembering the past.
Well, Stan Sesser, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about Cambodia. Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Stan Sesser is a staff writer at The New Yorker magazine. He writes about Southeast Asia. His article about Cambodia is in the current edition of The New Yorker. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.